With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, Halima.
Hi, Ioni.
And hello to the listeners. Welcome to the Polyester Podcast. I'm Ioni, and I'm the founding editor-in-chief of Polyester and the author of Poor Little Sick Girls.
And I'm Halima, the community editor of Polyester Scene and the co-host of the Polyester Podcast.
This is the Sleepover Club, a feminist pop culture podcast. We pull apart the hashtag discourse in the hope of making some sense of it all.
Before we get started, please like, rate, review, and subscribe. Do we have any reviews to read out this week, Ioni?
We absolutely do, Halima. So, 10 out of 10, 5 stars. Thank you for being so intersectional. I love how much you include class in your conversations where I feel like it is so often left out of the conversation. Great, unique topics has been very nice to listen to from Kevin James Jorts in Canada.
Oh, lovely.
International.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. What are we talking about this week, Ioni?
I think you should tell us, Halima.
This week, I'm interviewing Ioni Gamble about her debut book, Poor Little Sick Girls.
Woo, 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 woo.
I had the pleasure of reading it over the weekend, and I have formulated some thoughts and some questions about it.
Okay.
First of all, congratulations, Ioni. It is a really brilliant book. I'm so proud of you.
Thanks, Halima.
I'm getting so emotional.
You're such a cow.
But honestly, congrats. You did a fantastic job.
Thank you.
Okay. First and foremost, can you tell us a little bit about what Poor Little Sick Girls is about for those who do not know?
I'm sorry. So bad.
I know you hate this question.
I'm so bad at it. Okay. Poor Little Sick Girls is a collection of essays that looks at contemporary feminism, social media, the internet, and other facets of social politics through the lens of me having chronic illness.
Amazing. Thank you. My first question, like this first set of questions, are kind of about the writing process.
Okay.
And I wondered, what was the hardest thing about writing Poor Little Sick Girls, and what was the most enjoyable thing about writing it?
The hardest thing was writing it. It was really hard. I didn't like it. It feels like such a stupid privileged position to be like, wah, I got to write a book. It's so hard. But I definitely found it really challenging just to write that much stuff. See, I'm obviously a fucking bimbo, so how did I write a book? I don't know. Yeah, it was just really difficult in many ways. But something that I really loved about it was the research part of it. So I feel like whenever I got in a kind of a slump about the writing, I would just be able to go to research, and then that would make me feel like I was still being productive but not actually having to put my thoughts down. So that was good. Yeah.
Nice. Thank you. Another question I have is about the introduction of the book. So in the introduction of your book, you mentioned that the fact that you have always annoyingly known who you were meant to be.
Yeah.
And you say, and I quote, "Daydreaming about my future self was a far more effective way, form of escapism than any book or film would allow me."
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know where that came from, not to girl boss you. Yeah, that's a slur. But it's clear that you've always had a certain drive to achieve something bigger than yourself.
Mm.
I think it's actually quite a working class mentality. But I wanted to know if you could explain where that drive came from, because it's clear you had it from a very young age.
I don't know. I feel like it just happened. I feel like I always thought I had to have a plan. I think that was something that my mum was very influential on me doing, if that makes sense. Not in a weird pushy way. She wouldn't really care what I got in school or any of this sort of thing, but to know what I wanted to do was always really important to her, I think, and to me. I remember in year 8 I don't know why you have fucking careers days in year 8, which is when you're 13 for international listeners. Oh, it must have been year 9, because I think it was when you decide what to do for your GCSEs. Yeah. So when you're like 14. And I remember my mum being like, she should be a journalist, blah, blah, and I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. And then I got into the idea, well, kind of, like, basically when I was in year 10, they make you start looking at unis. It's just so insane, like, the schooling system here that you're meant to know what you want to do when you're 15. But I basically found this course, which was called, like, fashion promotion or whatever, and I ended up doing fashion journalism, but they're very similar. Like, fashion promotion is basically, like, styling or marketing or whatever. And I was like, I'm going to do that course and I'm going to go to that uni. And then I did that. So I feel like it's just something I've always known in some way that I want to, like, I wanted to be doing what I'm doing now, which I'm very lucky for. And it started with just being like, I'm going to go to Oxford and then I'm going to write Harry Potter like J.K. Rowling when I was like 6. Obviously, I don't want to be like her anymore. Cancelled. We hate her. But yeah, I do think it's like a working class mentality in a way. In a way, like, I feel like it probably swings both sides of the class spectrum. Like, because if you're really upper class, then there's more certainty. Like, you know what school you're going to go to. You know, like, what uni course you're probably going to do, probably because it's probably going to be at Oxbridge. But yeah, I feel like having a clear set of goals was always really important to me.
Well, I remember I had a careers day as well when I was in like year 9 or year 10. And I remember telling the man who, like, I don't know what he was doing, but he asked me what I wanted to do when I was older. And I said I wanted to be in journalism. And he goes, it's a dying industry. Ah! You should never go into it. And I was like, oh, okay.
He said that.
Yeah.
But what was his job?
I have no fucking clue. I can't remember. He was awful though. And I was a bit like, oh, okay. Maybe let me rethink this whole thing.
Yeah, people are quite horrible.
People are crazy. But I think you're right. Like, I think it definitely is probably a thing that goes beyond class. I think both sets of people probably have this thing. But I always think that working class people, because even I remember I used to do the same thing. I used to daydream about like what my life would be like as a way of like thinking beyond what I had now. If yeah. that made sense. It kind of just got me through the fact that I had very little.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a thing. Whereas like before, and I think the word like dream is quite central to that. So where like we say it's daydreaming or whatever, like probably upper class people, it's like expectation, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're here now. We made it.
We made it.
And you.
Oh my God. Okay. So you later go on to talk about your Crohn's diagnosis in the introduction. And how piece by piece the vision you conjured up about your adult life, like what your adult life would look like, began to fall apart. Mm. And, you know, I know you, and I know that you don't like when things don't go as planned.
Oh my God.
So I wondered, how did you handle that when you were younger? It's a lot.
I think with just like ignoring it and ignorance, like I didn't really think it would be bad and that it would change anything, so I was quite successful in that, in ignoring it through uni. I managed to still do all the things I wanted to do for my course, and like I probably went a bit above and beyond, like who fucking cares if you go to uni in first year, but I like took it really seriously. And then it was kind of when I got, because obviously at uni you have a certain amount of a cushion around you anyway, like it's not really real life, is it? Not to disrespect anyone that's at uni, but it's been 10 years now. And then when you have a job and these people don't really have a responsibility or a duty of care towards you in any way, that was kind of when I realized that I couldn't really operate in the world in a way that I wanted to, because my body wouldn't let me, A, and like B, the people around me in a professional setting wouldn't be accommodating to the things that I needed in order to make it work.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that you mentioned that you ignored it, because we were in the car this morning and Annie's like, Annie's not feeling well at the minute. Annie goes, something's wrong with my stomach, but I'm not dealing with it until after my big lunch. So she's the same. Oh, God. Okay. In the tragic and gorgeous history of Sick Girls, you speak about how society treats the sick and disabled, and you bring up an important topic about the benefits of speaking up about your illness or keeping it a secret, which I found really interesting. And I think that we're speaking about this more and more, especially after the deaths of Virgil Abloh and Chadwick Boseman, because they both kept their illnesses a secret. And in the book, you wrote that you once thought that the simple act of talking would help us progress into a more equal society. We will speak about this in the last episode. Listen to the last episode if you haven't listened to it. Yeah. But now you don't think that's the case. Why do you no longer kind of subscribe to this like idea of like talk politics?
Because it doesn't work. Like, I feel like it's been like a decade now, no? And it's a hard one because, what did we say? I don't know if I was saying this on this podcast or something else, because I've been having to talk too much recently. But it's like, essentially where we speak on the internet, we're always catering to like the gays that we're not, for example, at the moment, which I think is a problem. So for example, you can say like, oh, I'm unwell, so I want to speak about being unwell to provide awareness to other unwell people. But really, you have to frame that for people that are not sick or are not disabled, because that's the majority of people that are going to look at that content. And it provides this kind of like voyeuristic understanding that isn't a real understanding. Like, these people can feel like they're like woke or whatever because they follow like five of whatever marginalization on Instagram. But then there's none of the practical tools that will help them be more understanding in their life, or like they'll still like, yeah, kick someone out of a job for being unwell, or like judge someone for whatever, like, you know, judge a fat person for being fat, judge like all these different things. And I think it's really interesting, the kind of like secret thing around Virgil and Chadwick, because like, it was Chadwick, wasn't it, that got like loads of shit when he was like looking like unwell. And you can see that kind of also happen now with Pete Davidson, who also has Crohn's. Like, people always being like, oh, he looks so like gone, or he looks like grey, or like whatever. And that's like actually a thing of having Crohn's, like when you're malnourished, whatever. And I think it's kind of a fucked if you do, fucked if you don't situation, which I write in the book. It's like you kind of like choose between being seen and like potentially having to deal with more shit but trying to feel understood, or you keep it a secret and like probably have an easier life at the end of the day. Like, I know that's not a very hopeful answer, but that's like where we're at the moment. And then it's so interesting, especially with those like two people being so high profile, because the way we frame their illness, being like, oh, they trudged through, like they're inspirational because they hid it, like in some weird way it's like that's the narrative, like they're inspirational because they were sick and they did so much and like blah 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 blah. It's not as if that's all untrue, but it's like, under what circumstances do we make, like, you know, they're both like high profile black men, feel the need that they have to hide this thing about themselves that, yeah, ultimately now they're not here. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. What was I gonna say? You, because obviously this is quite a dramatic switch to thinking that it's important to speak, and then obviously questioning that. Was it something that specifically happened that made you think, actually, this doesn't fucking work?
I think it's more just like a series of small things over time, and like, I suppose just like the difference in how you position yourself in the world. Because like we were kind of talking about last week, like when you're a young adult and you have loads and loads of confidence and you feel like you can just kind of tackle anything head on, and in a way, I think that also comes from, like, that confidence comes from the assumption that it's other people's responsibility to deal with your shit, in that, like, and, like, accept it and have good reactions to you. So I remember, like, when I came back from hospital, the first time I was in hospital, like, I was in first year of uni, and my housemate at uni just literally never spoke to me again, like, ever. Like, not one word passed her lips towards me. It was so strange. And I suppose it was just, like, more and more. That's like quite an extreme thing that sounds extreme, but it's something that would happen to me in a thousand of different ways, like as I move through adulthood, like small reactions or this. And it's not that I would actively hide my Crohn's disease, but whereas before I would like declare it, I then became like much more hesitant to be that upfront with people if they were like new or a colleague or like whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I feel like, how do you tackle that? Because obviously it's weird, because the idea in our society now is that you shouldn't have to be silent about those things, but it seems to be the easier option for the person who is dealing with that to keep it to themselves.
I think it's just the girls that get it and the girls that don't. Like, I also think it's a problem now because like I think it's also another reason why we see the kind of discourse and those who lead it, the type of people that do that, like they're the type of people that can afford to be ostracized. So like they're rich, or they're like on the like higher end of the privileged section whatever, in like some ways. So we have this kind of imbalance of like, especially within illness, but in like everything, like literally everything, like plus size activism, like race activism, a lot of the time where it's dominated by upper classes because they're the people that have like time, resources, energy, and can like afford not to lose, they can afford to lose income or whatever because people still take them seriously for other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's still important to talk about things. And I think especially be balanced in this way when you talk and like actually think about it and not just throw stuff out there, because I do think we are seeing a rise in illness discourse online that's very veered towards like the self-diagnosis and like things like this. And I don't think that's meaningful, because like at the end of the day, if you're throwing up like stories about feeling sick all the time, and like I just feel like it's a short validation thing, like similar to with mental health, like posting a crying story, it makes you feel good in the moment, but then people can turn that back on you. I don't think we're still at that place where we know what a good approach forward is, if that makes sense.
Yeah. This links to a question I was thinking about, actually, because you're quite honest in the book about things to do with your illness and like things people would think.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Are gross, like the idea that whenever you're in a room or in a place, you're always thinking, where's the nearest toilet in case I need to use the toilet, or the idea that you could almost like shit yourself or whatever. So you're very honest about those things. Where, how did you balance like the private and what you would make public?
So I think like when I came to writing the book, I basically didn't want to make it one of those feminist books that doesn't actually say what it wants it to, what you know the author is thinking. Like, I feel like there's so many books that kind of tiptoe around issues or sugarcoat them or don't say things because it might have consequences elsewhere. And like, I am privileged enough in my position now to say what I want and like have been living with this long enough to know what I feel comfortable and uncomfortable with, if that makes sense. Like, so I'll talk about shitting myself, but I won't talk about my sex life. Like, you know, we draw our own lines in this world. But I was thinking about basically all the writing I love and like all the books I've really enjoyed that kind of, whether they intersect with illness or not, and especially like Viv Albertine, both of her books, which are Clothes, Music, Boys and To Throw Away Unopened. And that book, her first book, basically opens with a big like monologue. They're both autobiographical, about how she's like never gotten the appeal of wanking. It doesn't work for her. And I feel like you have to kind of make these, you have to make these decisions as to whether you're going to be honest or not. And I don't really see the point of writing memoir if you're not going to be honest and truthful, because, and like over the top, because we don't have enough of like this kind of messiness of women's experiences. And at the end of the day, you can't write about an illness that makes you shit yourself if you're not going to say you shit yourself. What's the point? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. In the same chapter, you mention that when you're first diagnosed with Crohn's, you would seek some sort of like to see representation of who else had Crohn's, and you found out that JFK and Kurt Cobain both had Crohn's. Mm-hmm. So I need to know, JFK, smash or pass?
Pass.
Why? you?
I know. I'm not going to fuck any politician.
I thought you were going to say smash.
Really?
Yeah. No, I would also pass.
Yeah.
Kurt Cobain, smash or pass?
Pass probably still as well.
Really? Yeah. That's so interesting. Okay. You heard it here first, folks.
Well, you know, apparently also Kurt Cobain was into like scat play. Like,
what the fuck is that?
Like shit play during sex.
Oh, okay.
Gina Tonic told me this. I don't know if it's a rumor.
Oh my god.
Halima was just saying, oh, we should start rumors. And then I'm literally.
Oh my god.
But no, it's still passed. I don't like doing that.
Okay. Okay. In your Beyond Millennial Pink chapter, which is all about the commodification of feminism and the history of its commodification, you write that you never imagined your adult self and your peers distancing themselves from the label of feminist, but you can see that becoming, like, more and more becoming a reality. This obviously has to do with the way feminism is being commodified. What do you think was the turning point for so many young women who were so proud of this label? Like, why do you think they're distancing themselves from the label of feminist recently?
So, I think overexposure, probably. And I think also seeing that basically nothing they thought was going to happened. I know this is so, like, it's kind of stupid. Like, not stupid, like, but I feel like, for example, when a big turning point for me was when Ed Miliband lost, like, the 2016 election. I can't remember what year it was. And then 15, maybe. And then B, Brexit. And then more recently, obviously way more recently, like the Roe vs. Wade stuff and like all of these things basically. And I just kind of realized that all progress can be undone in some way. And then obviously Trump as well, like all these huge things have happened to us in our lifetime that we realize that any progress that can be made can be unmade. And I never really considered that before that time, if that makes sense. Like Brexit feels like such like a, you know, like a weak political thing to talk about now. And it is. But at the time it felt like world's ending, love. So I think people are sick of it basically because the response to it being actually really hard to not only like move the needle in terms of rights and politics and even just representation is this like fierce commodification of it, which we've seen mostly in representation, like whether that is through like female politicians or through like models or through whatever. We've just kind of seen these politics that we thought were radical become like the most unradical thing ever. So I think that's why people are sick of it. But I am a firm believer in like trying to like never putting down the feminist label because it's important to keep fighting for the radical potential of it rather than rejecting it.
Because you mentioned that you think it's overexposure. Could you expand on that? What do you mean by overexposure?
I suppose I mean like just literally, you know, you see feminism on t-shirts, you see it on cushions, you see it on the front of wellness journals, you see it in pop songs. Like pop songs aren't about like heartbreak or sex anymore, they're about like self-love and feminism, just like all of these things. Like feminism is basically like so ingrained in our culture, but it's not real feminism, but okay, female empowerment, like whatever you want to call it, like feminism light, it's like so ingrained in everything. And I think a natural reaction to that is to reject it because like once something becomes the status quo, it's not like cool anymore or whatever. Like I know that's such like a weird thing to say, but it's like how Dorian Electra, when they were on this podcast, and I'm sure I bring it up all the time, were basically saying that like why the far right is so successful is because the left is basically positioned as like normie culture now, like it, you know, like not being racist and not being fat phobic and all these things are like accepted as some things we should do. So to rebel against that is to rebel towards like a more right wing strain of thinking. And we're going through this like phase of culture, but you know, it's like liberal culture, not feminist culture, that we need to rally against.
It's interesting because when I read like you saying that, because you do mention the overexposure thing in the book, and I was thinking that that was something that in Bell Hooks's Feminism is for Everybody, that's what she was advocating for, like this overexposure of feminism. And it's interesting because I don't think she thought that with this over, like with feminism really becoming the mainstream, I don't think she thought that there would be a strong reaction or opposition to that from people who were feminists. Or like, because again, it's not necessarily the kind of feminism that we want to see being overexposed, because it is mainstream feminism. It is like this very whitewashed, non-radical feminism that you see everywhere. But I feel like she in the book she didn't write it, but I don't think she saw that type of reaction to the overexposure of it, because to her that was a good thing. But I don't think it was necessarily this female empowerment, self-love type thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think it's also there's just this huge gap, isn't there? Like, there's a huge gap in what we see and what we're told. And then, like, for example, our ability to advocate for ourselves or our communities, like, the kind of, like, commodification of feminism hasn't actually left us any more capable of doing anything that is meaningful. It's just left us, like, with the language, I suppose.
You're right as well when you mention the things like Brexit and Trump and Roe versus Wade. You've articulated it so well, but the idea that all the things that we have fought for can literally be undone under our political systems. And I guess that's, you don't think about that. You think that, okay, we have it and it's done.
Yeah.
But the fight isn't done. But I don't know. You're so right in that regard. But and I was thinking about this the other day because I was like, I'm just so depressed by everything with Roe versus Wade and stuff like that. And I was like, I could somehow see why people turn to disassociative feminism. Like, especially last week, I was in my depression era. But I was really like, oh, I can really see how people... And even though I don't want to ever feel like that, because I don't think I'll ever drop the label of feminist, but I could feel it. I could feel just like... I felt like this feeling of the world ending and not knowing what to do, because you keep fighting and things just keep happening that aren't... So, like, I don't know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a tough one.
Yeah, it's not great news.
No. Oh, well. Last question. Okay, so you importantly note that in this commodification chapter, beyond Millennial Pink, you importantly note that the commodification of feminism isn't anything new. The case study you use is the suffragettes and the fact that they sold their wares, silk scarves, tops, accessories, and bags, and they named these bags after different famous members. Mm-hmm. And they elevated their members to celebrity status. You relate this back to our current movement's obsession with commodifying itself. However, don't you see this type of commodification as different than the one in our current society? I guess, like, because you're quite specific about the fact that this commodification is being used by corporations. And I was thinking, when the suffragettes were doing it, weren't they doing it to advance their own, like, or push their own political project or maybe fund their own, I don't know, organizations? Because is it necessarily the same type of commodification?
Yeah, it is. Because, like, you know, any number of these feminist influencers do the exact same thing. Their basic business model, like through like the feminist influencer thing, right? It's like, yeah, maybe you originally start like peddling other people's wares. How many of those feminist influencers would then say, oh, I do SponCon so I can advance my own practice, whether that is like making feminist art or making feminist books or making feminist like videos or making feminist whatever. It's the same, but on a highly individualized level, because then people write these, and then instead of like, you know, a scarf or, I mean, it could also be t-shirts, like anything, but let's take like a book model. How many authors would say like, oh, I'm writing this book so then I can like reinvest in my own feminist practice? It's just not on a community level because we're so like hyper individualistic.
Yeah. I guess, because I was thinking about this, because I was like, I don't know, because I assume they weren't just selling it, like, just to, I don't know, like, they weren't just selling it, because it's not this, I don't think it's necessarily the same as, like, a corporation selling it when it comes to suffragettes, because I assume they needed to fund, like, the stuff that they were.
Yeah, but then also, it's like, so the suffragettes did do this, yes, they had, like, a headquarters that was, like, part shop, part, like, headquarters, but then... Liberties, for example, added like a suffragette section to their magazine, and like it would be like a shopping page, like how to get the suffragette look. The same for Selfridges. So it became like this identity more than just like them selling bags, if that makes sense, to like self-fund.
But even like, I feel like with them selling how to get the suffragettes look, I feel like even that to some extent is them still trying to sell their political project, right?
But it wasn't the suffragettes. I'm saying like Liberties. The shops. Or like Selfridges started doing that. Like these department stores.
Weren't Selfridges in support of the suffragettes, right?
Yeah.
You read that in the book. Was any of that money going back to the suffragettes? Or was it was staying with Selfridges?
Yeah, of course.
What?
And like Liberties would sell these corsets that they'd market for protest corsets. Like that would be comfortable while protesting. But it's all like marketed towards women's lib. It wasn't like made in conjunction with Women's Lib.
Wow, because I was really surprised when you wrote the fact that suffrages were in support, because you write in the beginning, like, you know, this shop is actually quite white and middle class now. So yeah. It's surprising to hear that their history was actually in support of...
But suffragettes were white and middle class, like upper class.
Of course, yeah.
Like, shops were basically in that moment, like, one of the only places women could go and gather. Mm-hmm. So that's why they were such, like, successful... like organizing tools. Mm-hmm. So I think it's you know, like, it's naive to dismiss the potential of using these things to our advantage, but it's just like, the who does it benefit?
Yeah. Okay, last question, Aina Gamble.
Okay,
what do you want people to take away from Poor Little Sick Girls?
I actually hate this question.
Lol.
Thank you for your thoughtful questions, but I hate this one. I always ask it to other people, so now I'm like, I'm never asking anyone that question.
It's the easiest way to end it off. I don't know how else to end this.
No, it's a good question. I'm not criticizing you. It's just because I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I just want people to, like, have the tools to, like, put why they feel uncomfortable into words, like, and, like, have these arguments presented to them that there is a better way. And, like, especially with the... like feminist arguments in there, that, like, we don't exist in a vacuum. Like, we are not just making our own history. This isn't the first time this has happened in terms of, like, a feminist lifespan of a movement. Like, this has happened time and time again, but because it's our first time experiencing it, like, our generation, we feel like it's unique to us. Whereas, yeah, I feel like there's a lot to learn from our past, and I also hope people, like, just like it.
Nice.
Find it entertaining.
Yes. But yeah, that's all the questions I had for you.
Thank you
today. Anna. Thank you, Ione.
What a grilling.
Whoa, yeah.
Should people buy the book as someone who has read it?
I think you should absolutely buy the book. Get it for your mum, for your dad, for your nan, for your brother, for your sister. It's great. I really enjoyed reading it. It made me think very critically, which I always love. So I highly recommend. In Halima's book corner, I give it 10 out of 10.
Oh, thank you, Halima.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you for the lovely interview.
Thank you for your time.
I'll see you next week.
Adios.
Thank you to Rodrigo.
Thank you to Rodrigo. We love you.
Us right now. Thank you to Olivia and to Gina and Gina, Charlotte, Eden, Gina again. Hattie and Grace, and that's it. Thank you. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.